Chapter 48. He had repeated, unable to hide his consternation. If it had not been that I am given the news by a man of your position, I would never have believed it. Astonishing. An armed force, corrected the engineer, suavely. His aim was attained. It was to keep Sulaco clear of any armed occupation for a few hours longer, to let those whom fear impelled leave the town. In the general dismay there were families hopeful enough to fly upon the road towards Los Hatos, which was left open by the withdrawal of the armed rabble under Senators Fuentes and Camacho, to Rincon, with their enthusiastic welcome for Pedro Montero. It was a hasty and risky exodus, and it was said that Hernandez, occupying with his band the woods about Los Hatos, was receiving the fugitives. That a good many people he knew were contemplating such a flight had been well known to the chief engineer. Father Corbelan's efforts in the cause of that most pious robber had not been altogether fruitless. The political chief of Sulaco had yielded at the last moment to the urgent entreaties of the priest, had signed a provisional nomination appointing Hernandez a general, and calling upon him officially in this new capacity to preserve order in the town. The fact is that the political chief, seeing the situation desperate, did not care what he signed. It was the last official document he signed before he left the palace of the Intendencia for the refuge of the O.S.S. and Company's office. But even had he meant his act to be effective, it was already too late. The riot which he feared and expected broke out in less than an hour after Father Corbelan had left him. Indeed, Father Corbelan, who had appointed a meeting with Nostromo in the Dominican convent, where he had his residence in one of the cells, never managed to reach the place. From the Intendencia he had gone straight on to the Avellanos' house to tell his brother-in-law, and though he stayed there no more than half an hour, he had found himself cut off from his ascetic abode. Nostromo, after waiting there for some time, watching uneasily the increasing uproar in the street, had made his way to the offices of the Porvenir, and stayed there till daylight, as Decad had mentioned in the letter to his sister. Thus the Capitas, instead of riding towards the Los Hatos woods as bearer of Hernandez's nomination, had remained in town, to save the life of the president dictator, to assist in repressing the outbreak of the mob, and at last to sail out with the silver of the mine. But Father Corbelan, escaping to Hernandez, had the document in his pocket, a piece of official writing turning a bandit into a general in a memorable last official act of the Ribierist party, whose watchwords were honesty, peace, and progress. Probably neither the priest nor the bandit saw the irony of it. Father Corbelan must have found messengers to send into the town, for early on the second day of the disturbances there were rumors of Hernandez being on the road to Los Hatos ready to receive those who would put themselves under his protection. A strange-looking horseman, elderly and audacious, had appeared in the town, riding slowly while his eyes examined the fronts of the houses, as though he had never seen such high buildings before. Before the cathedral he had dismounted, and, kneeling in the middle of the plaza, his bridle over his arm and his hat lying in front of him on the ground, had bowed his head, crossing himself and beating his breast for some little time. Remounting his horse, with a fearless, but not unfriendly look round the little gathering formed about his public devotions, he had asked for the Casa Avellanos. A score of hands were extended in answer, with fingers pointing up the Calle de la Constitución. The horseman had gone on with only a glance of casual curiosity upwards to the windows of the Amarillo Club at the corner. His stentorian voice shouted periodically in the empty street, "Which is the Casa Avellanos?" Till an answer came from the scared porter, and he disappeared under the gate. The letter he was bringing, written by Father Corbelan with a pencil by the campfire of Hernandez, was addressed to Don Jose, of whose critical state the priest was not aware. Antonia read it, and, after consulting Charles Gould, sent it on for the information of the gentleman garrisoning the Amarillo Club. For herself, her mind was made up. She would rejoin her uncle. She would entrust the last day, the last hours perhaps of her father's life to the keeping of the bandit, whose existence was a protest against the irresponsible tyranny of all parties alike, against the moral darkness of the land. The gloom of Los Hatos woods was preferable, a life of hardships in the train of a robber band less debasing. Antonia embraced with all her soul her uncle's obstinate defiance of misfortune. It was grounded in the belief in the man whom she loved. In his message the vicar general answered upon his head for Hernandez's fidelity. As to his power, he pointed out that he had remained unsubdued for so many years. In that letter Decatur's idea of the new Occidental state, whose flourishing and stable condition is a matter of common knowledge now, was for the first time made public, and used as an argument. Hernandez, expanded in the last general of Ribierist creation, was confident of being able to hold the tract of country between the woods of Los Hatos and the coast range till that devoted patriot, Don Martin Decatur, could bring General Barrios back to Sulaco for the reconquest of the town. Heaven itself wills it. Providence is on our side, wrote Father Corbelin. There was no time to reflect upon or to controvert his statement, and if the discussion started upon the reading of that letter in the Amarillo Club was violent, it was also short-lived. In the general bewilderment of the collapse, some jumped at the idea with joyful astonishment, as upon the amazing discovery of a new hope. Others became fascinated by the prospect of immediate personal safety for their women and children. The majority caught at it as a drowning man catches at a straw. Father Corbelin was unexpectedly offering them a refuge from Pedrito Montero with his Lineros allied to Senors Fuentes and Camacho with their armed rabble. All the latter part of the afternoon an animated discussion went on in the big rooms of the Amarillo Club. Even those members posted at the windows with rifles and carbines to guard the end of the street in case of an offensive return of the populace shouted their opinions and arguments over their shoulders. As dusk fell, Don Juste Lopez, inviting those caballeros who were of his way of thinking to follow him, withdrew into the corridor, where at a little table in the light of two candles he busied himself in composing an address, or rather a solemn declaration, to be presented to Pedrito Montero by a deputation of such members of assembly as had elected to remain in town. His idea was to propitiate him in order to save the form at least of parliamentary institutions. Seated before a blank sheet of paper, a goose quill pen in his hand, and searched upon from all sides, he turned to the right and to the left, repeating with solemn insistence, "Caballeros, a moment of silence. A moment of silence. We ought to make it clear that we bow in all good faith to the accomplished facts." The utterance of that phrase seemed to give him a melancholy satisfaction. The hubbub of voices round him was growing strained and hoarse. In the sudden pauses the excited grimacing of the faces would sink all at once into the stillness of profound dejection. Meantime, the exodus had begun. Carretas full of ladies and children rolled swaying across the plaza, with men walking or riding by their side. Mounted parties followed on mules and horses. The poorest were setting out on foot, men and women carrying bundles, clasping babies in their arms, leading old people, dragging along the bigger children. When Charles Gould, after leaving the doctor and the engineer at the Casa Viola, entered the town by the harbor gate, all those that had meant to go were gone, and the others had barricaded themselves in their houses. In the whole dark street there was only one spot of flickering lights and moving figures, where the senior administrator recognized his wife's carriage waiting at the door of the Avellanos house. He rode up, almost unnoticed, and looked on without a word, while some of his own servants came out of the gate carrying Don Jose Avellanos, who, with closed eyes and motionless features, appeared perfectly lifeless. His wife and Antonia walked on each side of the improvised stretcher, which was put at once into the carriage. The two women embraced. While from the other side of the land the Father Corbelin's emissary, with his ragged beard all streaked with gray, and high, bronze cheekbones, stared, sitting upright in the saddle. Then Antonia, dry-eyed, got in by the side of the stretcher, and, after making the sign of the cross rapidly, lowered a thick veil upon her face. The servants and the three or four neighbors who had come to assist, stood back, uncovering their heads. On the box, Ignatia, resigned now to driving all night and to having perhaps his throat cut before daylight, looked back surlily over his shoulder. "Drive carefully," cried Mrs. Gould in a tremulous voice. "Sigh, carefully, S.I. Nina," he mumbled, chewing his lips, his round leathery cheeks quivering. And the lander rolled slowly out of the light. "I will see them as far as the ford," said Charles Gould to his wife. She stood on the edge of the sidewalk with her hands clasped lightly, and nodded to him as he followed after the carriage. And now the windows of the Amarilla Club were dark. The last spark of resistance had died out. Turning his head at the corner, Charles Gould saw his wife crossing over to their own gate in the lighted patch of the street. One of their neighbors, a well-known merchant and landowner of the province, followed at her elbow, talking with great gestures. As she passed in, all the lights went out in the street, which remained dark and empty from end to end. The houses of the vast plaza were lost in the night. High up, like a star, there was a small gleam in one of the towers of the cathedral, and the equestrian statue gleamed pale against the black trees of the Alameda, like a ghost of royalty haunting the scenes of revolution. The rare prowlers they met ranged themselves against the wall. Beyond the last houses the carriage rolled noiselessly on the soft cushion of dust, and with a greater obscurity a feeling of freshness seemed to fall from the foliage of the trees bordering the country road. The emissary from Hernandez's camp pushed his horse close to Charles Gould. "Caballero," he said in an interested voice, "you are he whom they call the King of Sulaco, the master of the mine? Is it not so?" "Yes, I am the master of the mine," answered Charles Gould. The man cantered for a time in silence, then said, "I have a brother, a sereno in your service in the San Tome Valley. You have proved yourself a just man. There has been no wrong done to anyone since you called upon the people to work in the mountains. My brother says that no official of the government, no oppressor of the campo, has been seen on your side of the stream. Your own officials do not oppress the people in the gorge. Doubtless they are afraid of your severity. You are a just man and a powerful one," he added. He spoke in an abrupt, independent tone, but evidently he was communicative with a purpose. He told Charles Gould that he had been a ranchero in one of the lower valleys, far south, a neighbor of Hernandez in the old days, and godfather to his eldest boy, one of those who joined him in his resistance to the recruiting raid which was the beginning of all their misfortunes. It was he that, when his compadre had been carried off, had buried his wife and children, murdered by the soldiers. "Sigh, senor," he muttered, hoarsely, "I and two or three others, the lucky ones left at liberty, buried them all in one grave near the ashes of their ranch, under the tree that had shaded its roof." It was to him, too, that Hernandez came, after he had deserted, 3 years afterwards. He had still his uniform on with the sergeant's stripes on the sleeve, and the blood of his colonel upon his hands and breast. Three troopers followed him, of those who had started in pursuit, but had ridden on for liberty. And he told Charles Gould how he and a few friends, seeing those soldiers, lay in ambush behind some rocks ready to pull the trigger on them, when he recognized his compadre and jumped up from cover, shouting his name, because he knew that Hernandez could not have been coming back on an errand of injustice and oppression. Those three soldiers, together with the party who lay behind the rocks, had formed the nucleus of the famous band, and he, the narrator, had been the favorite lieutenant of Hernandez for many, many years. He mentioned proudly that the officials had put a price upon his head too, but it did not prevent it getting sprinkled with gray upon his shoulders. And now he had lived long enough, to see his commander made a general. He had a burst of muffled laughter. And now from robbers we have become soldiers. But look, Caballero, at those who made us soldiers and him a general. Look at these people. Ignatius shouted. The light of the carriage lamps, running along the noble edges that crowned the bank on each side, flashed upon the scared faces of people standing aside in the road, sunk deep, like an English country lane, into the soft soil of the campo. They cowered, their eyes glistened very big for a second, and then the light, running on, fell upon the half-denuded roots of a big tree, on another stretch of noble edge, caught up another bunch of faces glaring back apprehensively. Three women, of whom one was carrying a child, and a couple of men in civilian dress, one armed with a saber and another with a gun, were grouped about a donkey carrying two bundles tied up in blankets. Further on, Ignatius shouted again to pass a carreta, a long wooden box on two high wheels, with the door at the back swinging open. Some ladies in it must have recognized the white mules, because they screamed out, "Is it you, Dona Emilia?" At the turn of the road, the glare of a big fire filled the short stretch vaulted over by the branches meeting overhead. Near the ford of a shallow stream, a roadside rancho of woven rushes and a roof of grass had been set on fire by accident, and the flames, roaring viciously, lit up an open space blocked with horses, mules, and a distracted, shouting crowd of people. When Ignatia pulled up, several ladies on foot assailed the carriage, begging Antonia for a seat. To their clamor she answered, by pointing silently to her father. "I must leave you here," said Charles Gould, in the uproar. The flames leaped up sky high, and in the recoil from the scorching heat across the road the stream of fugitives pressed against the carriage. A middle-aged lady dressed in black silk, but with a coarse manta over her head, and a rough branch for a stick in her hand, staggered against the front wheel. Two young girls, frightened and silent, were clinging to her arms. Charles Gould knew her very well. "Misericordia! We are getting terribly bruised in this crowd," she exclaimed, smiling up courageously to him. "We have started on foot. All our servants ran away yesterday to join the Democrats. We are going to put ourselves under the protection of Father Corbelin, of your sainted uncle, Antonia. He has wrought a miracle in the heart of a most merciless robber. A miracle." She raised her voice gradually up to a scream as she was borne along by the pressure of people getting out of the way of some carts coming up out of the ford at a gallop, with loud yells and cracking of whips. Great masses of sparks mingled with black smoke flew over the road. The bamboos of the walls detonated in the fire with the sound of an irregular fusillade. And then the bright blaze sank suddenly, leaving only a red dust crowded with aimless dark shadows drifting in contrary directions. The noise of voices seemed to die away with the flame, and the tumult of heads, arms, quarreling, and imprecations passed on fleeing into the darkness. "I must leave you now," repeated Charles Gould to Antonia. She. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.